So I'm going to at least start this afternoon. What we talked about this morning is, at least I tried to convince the audience that we do have an issue with antimicrobial resistance, and E. coli was my bug of choice. So that's what we focused on, and I think there was a pretty convincing argument. Then we talked a little bit about culture susceptibility testing and how you can use that to help you not only select a drug but also to design a dosing regimen, because one of the points that I made during this morning's session is that empirical antimicrobial therapy is not nearly as successful today as it was perhaps 10, 15 years ago, in part because I don't think we do a real good job in guessing what it is that we are treating. And we talked a little bit about not using antibiotics indiscriminately because of the risk of resistance. And then I said that if you use them and you've made the decision to use them, then what I hope very much is that you will use them correctly, which is what this session is going to kind of focus on. So to begin the session, I'm just going to kind of review a little bit of what I said in the first session, and that is these are now the steps that I teach and I use when I approach antimicrobial therapy, with the first and most important question being, do I need to treat? The second most important item is matching the target to the drug so that I can narrow the spectrum of the drug as much as possible. And, of course, that's very hard to do, but I think it's very important to try and do it. And then, thirdly, does the drug get to the site and ultimately designing the dosing regimen? So we're going to talk about taking this information and putting it in the patient. And towards the end of this session, we will talk about host and microbial factors that make your job all the more harder. But before we get there, what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit more about using culture and susceptibility testing to design your therapy. And those of you that were here this morning, you'll recognize this slide. This was an example of two isolates collected, for example, from a dog's ear, where I have minimum inhibitory concentration, the numbers here. And one of the things I showed you how to do, when you get this kind of information from the patient, if you're trying to discriminate among these S's, one of the things that you can do to compare these drugs is take the MIC of the isolate that is infecting your patient and compare that MIC, which is an indicator of how much you need, to how much you're going to get using what is called the breakpoint MIC, which is a threshold of susceptibility. And just a reminder that this threshold of susceptibility is generated by CLASI, which is a national organization that sets standards for laboratories. It is what appropriate laboratories use. All laboratories use the same numbers. And so if you were to have these numbers from IDEX, then Antech would use the same numbers, as should any antimicrobial testing laboratory that you should use in the United States. And these do change every couple of years, and a good laboratory will provide that information for you because it is an indicator of what you need to get your bug. And so the examples that I used based on the breakpoint MIC is I said, okay, let's look at cephalothin and amoxicillin clavulanic acid. It looks like cephalothin's a better choice because it's got a, amoxicillin clavulanic acid is a better choice because it has a lower MIC, but that's like comparing apples to oranges, or at least maybe, since these are both beta-lactams, it's like comparing Macintosh apples to Gala apples. Because what we have to do is normalize this number, which is an indicator of what I need, to what we're going to get, which is the breakpoint MIC. And in the last session, I did point out that there's two numbers here for the beta-lactams, amoxicillin and amoxicillin clavulanic acid, because this is a staph intermedius. Staph intermedius produces beta-lactamases, and CLASI, who sets these standards, has recognized that the beta-lactamase destruction of the drug actually reduces the amount of drug at the site. So for staph intermedius, we are actually using an amoxicillin clavulanic acid. We're using the 8 here rather than the 32. If it were any other organism, we would use the 32. All right, so what do we do with this? Well, we simply calculated inhibitory quotients. What we did is we divided the Cmax, in this case 8, which is what I'm going to get, by what I need, the 2, and we came up with 4 for amoxicillin clavulanic acid, and we came up with 8, basically 8, not greater than 8, but 8 for cephalothin. And that means, therefore, that cephalothin actually would be the better choice here because the isolate is more susceptible to cephalothin. You're going to get a greater distance between what you need and what you're going to get. And then we did the same thing with amoxicillin, I'm sorry, with amikacin and enrofloxacin. Again, it looks like enrofloxacin would be the better choice, but the reality is you are going to get much more amikacin in the bloodstream when you give the recommended dose of amikacin than you are when you give the recommended dose of enrofloxacin. And if you calculate the same inhibitory quotients, in this scenario, your inhibitory quotient for amikacin would be greater than 32, versus for enrofloxacin, it would only be 16. Again, indicating that amikacin would be a much better choice. And this is less than or equal to 2 because this means the lab did not test any lower than 2, and so the best we can do is assume that it's 2. And then we went through and we showed you how you would use this in a patient. This was proteus that we collected from the tympanic bulla intraoperatively. We've got lots of S's here. We've got MICs here. The question is which of these S's would be best. And so the first thing I did is I took away all the R's. And then I calculated inhibitory quotients, which is the MIC of the infecting organism for that drug, in the ratio of that compared to what I'm going to get, which was the breakpoint MIC. And so our inhibitory quotient for amikacin would be 32, and so on down this list. And so then what I did is I got rid of the ones that did not have the highest inhibitory quotients. What this suggests is that amikacin, enrofloxacin, or potentiate sulfonamides would be reasonable choices, with once again amikacin being the best. But of course, we don't want to use that systemically. So that's what we did the first session. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about what happens when you choose your drug. What do you do with this piece of information? And since in the first session, we start with amoxicillin clavulanic acid. That is the drug that I'm going to stick with as we talk about other factors that we need to be thinking about. So what we're going to do now is we're going to remind ourselves that this is an in vitro test that we're going to apply to the in vivo situation. Ideally, we want to get that, if we back up, and let me just back up. And so in this particular case, if this were Proteus or this were staph, the amount of drug that I would need to get this microbe would be 8 micrograms per mil or less. And we're going to use 8 because the lab didn't go any lower, so we're going to be conservative and use 8. So the problem with this, however, is that this MIC is based upon plasma drug concentrations in a relatively healthy patient. So these are in vitro conditions. And whether or not I achieve that MIC in my patient may not be good enough. And the question is, do I need to get higher? And so that's what we're going to spend this session talking about. And I kind of entitle it, Don't Underestimate the Challenge. As you move from the in vitro situation, the test tube, into the patient, it is a heck of a challenge. And we're going to talk about why and what you can do to accommodate for that challenge. First thing I'm going to remind you of is clearly we want to have bactericidal effects on board. If dead bugs don't mutate, the best way to make sure that we don't have resistant organisms is to kill them. And in the first session, I'll just reemphasize that frequently, even though you resolve the infection, you probably have caused resistance. It is very easy to have an infection resolve, but the resistant organisms are still in the patient. Most patients, that's not a problem, but it's the patient at risk, the geriatric, the immune-suppressed patient, where those resistant bugs that you've caused with your drug are going to come back and get you in trouble. And so that's kind of what we're focusing on here. So one of the best ways to make sure that we don't have resistant bugs, of course, is to make sure that we kill them. When I was in school, I was told to reach for a bactericidal drug so that I would kill the bugs. But the reality is that is an in vitro definition. And yes, we can marry bactericidal effects to mechanisms of action. We do that all the time. The fluoroquinolones are quote-unquote cidal, as are the beta-lactams, as is a potentiated sulfonamide, versus the drugs that target essentially ribosomes are considered to inhibit the growth of the organism and therefore be static. But the reality is that you can easily cause a quote-unquote cidal drug to act in a static fashion if you don't get enough drug at the site. So these are relatively false senses of security. Likewise, you can actually cause some static drugs to be cidal if you get sufficient drug at the site of infection to kill the bug. And we actually can do that with clindamycin and azithromycin, and we'll see that towards the end of the session. So don't get caught up in this false sense of security thinking, if I've reached for a cidal drug, I'm going to kill. Chances are you probably aren't unless you're using that drug appropriately. And that's what this session is all about. And of course, it becomes much more important when we have patients at risk, as I mentioned before. The immune-suppressed patient, the patient that has poor local immunity for whatever reason, such as the brain or osteomyelitis. All right, so taking it one step further, and this is where you're going to need to put your thinking cap on a little bit, because just just when we start thinking about MICs and we're at peace with MICs and what they mean to us and how we can use them to design our dosing regimen, we need to change it. It's not MICs anymore. We're now shifting gears to what is called MPC. What does that mean? Well, let's think about this. When you get your MIC from your isolate that's been collected, say, from the urinary tract, generally that reflects one isolate that has been picked up by the microbiology laboratory. They grow it up, they do all their work, and they come out with an MIC, which is what you get on your report. In this case, 4 micrograms per mil. But the reality is there's not just one colony forming unit in that patient. There's probably 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 7 colony forming units if you've got an infection. And if you went through and actually cultured all of those colony forming units that are infecting your patient and causing those clinical signs, the reality is you would have many different MICs. And in fact, if you were to plot these MICs out, you would see something like this. Now, the MIC that you got from the lab is probably the most common one. The statistics are going to say that. But the reality is that you have organisms on board, isolates on board, that have MICs that are much higher than the MIC that you got on your report. In fact, the highest MIC shown on this particular example, 16 micrograms per mil, this MIC is referred to as the mutant prevention concentration. Why? Because these guys have already undergone the first step mutation. They have already undergone a spontaneous mutation. Every time you get 10 to the 5, 10 to the 7 colony forming units, which is what it requires for an infection, there's going to be at least one spontaneous mutation in at least one isolate, and at least one isolate is going to be resistant to any drug you might choose to use. And if you come along with that drug, you're going to wipe everything else out. So this is called, this area between the MIC, which is what you get from the lab, and the MIC of the highest MIC that's infecting your patient, otherwise known as the MPC, this is called the mutant selection window. And it's the last place you want your drug concentrations to reach. Why? Because what will happen is if you come along with a drug targeting the MIC, you are going to wipe out all these guys down here. And what's going to happen is there's no more competition. These guys are going to emerge. And it's these guys that are going to cause reinfection or persistent infection in your problematic patient. And what will happen is they will grow again. They will reach a new population. And the next time around when you reculture this patient, you're now going to see the same isolate, but its MIC is going to be much higher. And it's happened because you did what we've been telling you to do for the last 10 years, and that's target the MIC. And what I'm telling you today is that ain't good enough. We've got to do much better than that, because what we're doing is we're selecting for resistance every time we do that. And I think that you see this clinically. We now have a new mutant selection window. We now have an even higher set of MICs. These are second step mutants here, and there's no way in the world you're going to be able to get enough drug on board safely to get these higher second step mutants. And just to show you, and you, for those of you that weren't in the first session, you didn't see this data, but I'll remind you, we did a prospective study. We collected 450 E. coli isolates from throughout the United States last year. And what we did is we subjected them to susceptibility testing. Well, I want to show you the MIC distributions for enrofloxacin. And all you see along here is for those 401 isolates that we've studied, this is the MIC, and this bar here represents how many isolates of those 401 had that particular MIC. So in this case, we had 90 isolates that had an MIC of 0.064. Well, here's the resistant breakpoint for enrofloxacin. So all these guys would be considered susceptible down here. Anything up here would be considered resistant. Now, this is very high-level resistance. This is actually the MIC 90 for E. coli is now greater than 32. And as I said in the earlier session, we're seeing marked resistance to the fluorinated quinolones with enrofloxacin. But that's not necessarily the point of this slide. What I wanted you to see with this slide, if this is the breakpoint MIC, this is the threshold of susceptibility that the labs use. Any isolate below this breakpoint would be considered susceptible. Any isolate with an MIC greater than this breakpoint would be considered resistant. Okay? Well, all these guys right here are probably first-step mutants, meaning that they probably have become relatively resistant to these drugs. Even though these organisms are considered quote-unquote susceptible, the problem is they've already undergone the first-step mutation. How do I know that? Because their MICs are so high. Their MICs should be way down here. but it's not. It's sneaking up to the breakpoint MIC. Second-step mutants are characterized by even higher MICs, usually 3 or 4-fold higher than the breakpoint MIC. So what we see in our normal population of dogs and cats, not normal population, but in dogs and cats that have E. coli infections, a fair amount of these isolates have already undergone the first-step mutation. But here's the problem. Here's the real reason this slide is in here. These are the concentrations that your laboratories test. The problem with our current susceptibility testing procedures is they only test a very narrow range, and by the time you get an S, this is the lowest concentration that they test, you probably already have a first-step mutant. So one of the problems that we have with our current laboratory methods is they can't help us identify those guys that are really, really susceptible versus those guys that have already undergone the first-step mutation. If you do have a lab that does MICs and you get an MIC for a fluorinated quinolone that is approaching the breakpoint, 0.5, 1, or 2, just assume that that isolate has already undergone the first-step mutation and you're on your way to a multidrug-resistant isolate. We've got to be very careful with the fluorinated quinolones. And I think that we see that, and it's true for all drugs as well, but as I said in the first session, one of the problems with the fluorinated quinolones is when they develop resistance, it's usually multidrug resistance. It's to tetracyclines, beta-lactams, everything except the aminoglycosides. And I think that you see that. The example here is this was a, I wonder what happened. Just a second. Oh, I had a description someplace, and it'll probably show up the last part of this slide. But this was a 3-year-old Weimaraner that had, we didn't know it at the time, had a urinary tract infection. It turns out it had polycystic renal disease, so she has pyelonephritis as well. First time we cultured her, this is E. coli. These are the drugs our lab does. These are the MICs. And again, this less than 8, less than 0.25, or this is less than or equal to, less than or equal to. We don't go any lower. That's as low as these labs go. And so I don't really know if this isolate has already undergone first-step mutation because I don't know how high that MIC is. Well, I can tell you that it probably had because this is what happened 2 weeks later after she was treated with enrofloxacin, I think at 10 mg per kg. You can see the same isolate now 2 weeks later, and look what's happened to these MICs. We've gone from 8 for moxicillin clavulanic acid up to 32. We've gone to less than or equal to 0.25 up to 2. And we see this all the time. I probably have seen, I'm guessing probably 100 of these since I've been at Auburn for the 3 years that I've been here. I get calls about these guys all the time. The only thing this isolate is now susceptible to is an aminoglycoside or nitrofurantoin. The last thing I want to use in a patient that has polycystic renal disease is an aminoglycoside, and I'm faced now with that decision. So I think the reason that we are seeing these is because we start out with drug concentrations that are too low and we cause the formation of if not first-step mutants, then second-step mutants. And this is just an example. Your standard antibiograms, when you look at what they do out there in most commercial laboratories, those will be the concentrations that they might test for amoxicillin clavulanic acid. So we only have an 8 to 20-fold range if we're lucky, and this for Enro it might be a little bit higher, but it's a very narrow range that they test. In the earlier session, I told you that I'd introduce you to the E-test. This is what's being used increasingly in human medicine. This is what we're using in our lab to detect resistance and susceptibility. And the nice thing about this E-test is look at the range that is tested. We go all the way from, and that should be 0.016, all the way up to 256, a 1,600-fold range in susceptibility. Why is this important to me? Because if I've got an isolate that is susceptible to a drug way down here, that is the drug that I will use. As this isolate approaches the breakpoint, it is an isolate that has already undergone the first-step mutation, and if I'm not very, very careful, I'm going to cause that isolate to become very resistant to my drug. And this is just what an E-test looks like when you set it up. The problem is it's very labor-intensive, one strip per drug. You can see how it looks when you do the susceptibility testing. This isolate is susceptible to amoxicillin clavulanic acid at 0.064, which is a very susceptible isolate because the breakpoint for E. coli is way up here. So increasingly, we'll probably see these in human medicine. I'm not sure if we'll get to them in veterinary medicine. I sure hope so because this is a powerful piece of information for you as a practitioner. Now, Just to let you know, we've asked the Morris Animal Foundation to fund a study to monitor E. coli, and we're going to work with IDEX to do that. And so if you send your samples to IDEX and you have an E. coli, chances are it's going to end up in our laboratory, and we're going to do this e-test for you, and we'll give you that result when it's made available. But I just wanted to give you a heads up. That's kind of where we're going with at least our interest in antimicrobials. So the bottom line is simply achieving the MIC in your patient is going to facilitate resistance. The further away your isolate's MIC is from the breakpoint that is set by CLASI, the more likely that drug's going to be effective and the more cavalier you can be with your dosing regimen. I'm going to ask you to not be cavalier, but the more cavalier you can be. Yes, ma'am. IDEX, the breakpoint is a threshold susceptibility that is set by CLASI, so the breakpoint is the same. What IDEX is going to do is send us E. coli so that we can actually see how susceptible your isolates are, because if they only test to 2 micrograms per mil, that's probably an organism that has already undergone the first step mutation. What we're interested in is how susceptible that isolate is, not just an S, but how S is it? We want to know how low it is, because that should give you some confidence that that drug can be used more effectively than an isolate whose MIC is closer to that breakpoint.
Are the breakpoints available?
IDEX can give you breakpoints. They actually should be in your notes. And remember, those breakpoints are the same. They're standards. They're the same throughout any laboratory. You can get them from IDEX. You can get them from Antech. The problem with most commercial laboratories is if you call them up and ask them for the breakpoints, usually the person you're talking to doesn't know what you're talking about. And it's really frustrating that they don't understand. Usually they are inherently in the software of the computer program that runs those automated systems. And that's why the microbiologists don't really understand what you're asking for sometimes. All they know is they stick the microbe in the machine and they get a card out 2 hours later and bam. And it's either got an S, an I, or an R by it. But Antech and IDEX can provide those. They tell me they're on their website. I can't get into their websites because I'm not a member. Okay. All right, so the bottom line is either exceed that mutant prevention concentration or mutant prevention concentration, or if you're going to mess up and underdose, just underdose really badly, because the nice thing is if you underdose really badly, then you won't inhibit anything and nothing will grow, or at least nothing will develop resistance. So either be way subtherapeutic, and I'm saying that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I think part of the reason that we've gotten away with not generating as much resistance as we have is because we've probably been using therapeutic doses that are so low that we really haven't impacted the population. We get in trouble when we start wiping out some of the population, but not all the population. So either don't wipe out anything or wipe out everything. Your two choices. Dead bugs don't mutate. That's what I tell my students their mantra is, dead bugs don't mutate. So what is the mutant prevention concentration? I don't know. I'm identifying problems once again without solutions. I can give you some examples. The problem is to detect them, you have to grow isolates up to 10 to the 7 colony forming units. And most labs only grow up to 10 to the 5. To detect 10 to the 7, you have to have a plate like this big. Now, what they're going to do in human medicine is they're going to come up with ways that we can actually detect the MPC, but we're not there yet. But to just give you an example, this is E. coli, and this is the MIC to fluorinated quinolones in general, MIC 90. This is the MPC. And so you can see that the ratio of MPC to MIC for at least E. coli is about 6 to 10. So it means that you would need in your patient's bloodstream 10 times the MIC. We're going to see that in just a couple minutes. I'm going to expect you to do that. I sound bad, don't I? But you actually can do that somewhat easily. Unfortunately, for gram-positives, it's even worse. Here's the MIC of 0.25. Here's the MPC of 25. And you can see that the difference is 20 to 125-fold higher. And this might sound like bunk, and this might sound like you can't get there, and it might sound like there's no way you're going to do it, and you may be right, and that's going to make the microbes very happy. They're still going to develop resistance. Whether or not we achieve this, they're still going to develop resistance. And again, I think we see this very, very frequently. Just to give you a heads up, I was asked in the earlier session if all the fluorinated quinolones behave the same. And the point that I made is, from a resistance standpoint, yes. If one fluorinated quinolone has an R by it, all of them would have it for that same isolate. But what does differ among the fluorinated quinolones is the level of susceptibility. Orbifloxacin and difloxacin in general, even though they might have an S by them, the MICs are higher and there's probably more resistance. These MICs are closer to the breakpoint. to take that point home for Staff aureus, the MIC and MPC relationship is 125. So this is difloxacin over here. This is emrifloxacin over here. So what I'm saying here is, at least for orbifloxacin and difloxacin, I think it's already most of these isolates have undergone their first step mutation for many of the different organisms. And those drugs you have to be extra careful of. You have to be ready to use higher doses to avoid resistance. So, what can you do? Well, designing the proper dosing interval, so modifying either the dose or the interval to try and minimize the advent of resistance. For fluorinated quinolones, add a second dose. Now, we've just now gotten to the point where everybody's comfortable giving the fluorinated quinolones once a day. Now I'm telling you, add another one. Don't divide the two, but if you want to minimize the advent of resistance, if you have a patient at risk, the smartest thing that you can do is add a second dose. And I'm usually dosing Enro at 20 mg per kg, so I'm talking about adding another 20 mg per kilogram dose in a patient at risk where, if you do generate resistance, that animal's going to develop another infection. I'd add another dose, or the other thing that you can do, a very powerful tool, is combination antimicrobial therapy. Either add a drug that will act either synergistically or additively. If it's gram-negative, it can be an aminoglycoside, it can be imipenem, it can be a beta-lactam, but add something to that fluorinated quinolone so that isolate now has to undergo not 10 to the 7 colony-forming units, but 10 to the 14 to develop resistance. So it gives you a much wider range of growth that you can tolerate if you use combination therapy. So those are two venues that you can do to minimize resistance. And again, remember, I'm talking about the patient at risk. Okay, so that leads us to the post-antibiotic effect, because what we're trying to do is minimize the advent of resistance. Well, one of the ways to do it is to design a dosing regimen that is proper for the drug that you're using. What am I talking about here? Well, about three decades ago, we recognized that antibiotics sometimes worked even though the antibiotic wasn't there. And the best example are the aminoglycosides. We use them once a day now. We do that from a safety standpoint, but we also do it from an efficacy standpoint. Now, the half-life of amikacin is 1 hour, maybe 2 hours if we're lucky. And we're asking you to use this drug every 24 hours. Well, after 6 hours at the most, 90% of that drug is gone. Why is it still working with a 24-hour dosing interval? Well, the reason is because it has a post-antibiotic effect. And what we know is that this post-antibiotic effect is very critical to the efficacy of certain drug classes. How important? Well, it depends upon the drug, and it does depend upon the bug. And what we know now is that we can categorize drugs into two general classes based upon the relationship between the MIC of the infecting organism, the plasma drug concentrations or tissue drug concentrations, and the duration of the post-antibiotic effect. For example, we'll talk about two classes. There are time-dependent drugs, and there are concentration-dependent drugs. We're going to talk about the time-dependent drugs first. What do we mean here? Well, if this is the MIC of your infecting microbe, for a time-dependent drug, for that drug to work the best, not only in get rid of the infection, but prevent resistance, plasma drug concentrations or tissue drug concentrations have to be above the MIC for at least 50% of the dosing interval. Time above the MIC should be at least 50% of the dosing interval. If you want to prevent resistance, it should be 75 to 100% above the dosing interval. What are some examples? Well, the beta-lactams are the best examples, and if you think about their mechanism of action, it makes sense. They work by mimicking a substrate that is inserted into the cell wall. Once that substrate is inserted into the cell wall is not rigid anymore. Now, the microorganism is breaking down old cell wall as it's getting ready to build new cell wall, and so what happens is the cell wall is very faulty. Well, that's fine until the beta-lactam isn't there. As soon as the beta-lactam is no longer there, then the microorganism is going to start making good cell wall again, and so the drug won't work anymore. So for beta-lactams, we need to have the drug there for as long as we can during the dosing interval to impair the growth of the organism. So that means if we want to enhance the efficacy of time-dependent drugs, either get rid of the infection or preventing resistance, we need to shorten the dosing interval. Why? Well, the other group of time-dependent drugs are all those quote-unquote static drugs. Anything that is a ribosomal inhibitor, anything that we classify as static, is also a time-dependent drug. And because of that, we should be shortening the dosing interval. Well, I'm going to use as an example amoxicillin clavulinic acid. It tends to be one of our favorite drugs. And let's assume here that the MIC of the infecting microbe is 2 micrograms per mil. Let's assume this is E. coli. Now, that's a very susceptible isolate, 2 micrograms per mil, because the break point is 32. I shouldn't say very susceptible, but it's quite susceptible. Break point is 32, and yet my isolate's MIC is 2. All right, so the question is, how long can I wait before I need to dose again? Let's say I want to use a 12-hour dosing interval. Can I do that? All right, well, if that's the case, if we want to use a 12-hour dosing interval, and we're going to be liberal, we're going to say, okay, I want my plasma drug concentrations to be above 2 for 50% of the dosing interval. So that means for 6 hours. So in this scenario, I want drug concentrations above 2 micrograms per mil, actually at the site of infection in the tissue, for 6 hours if I'm going to use a 12-hour dosing interval. Can I do it? Well, I need two pieces of information. I need to know the maximum drug concentration that I get when I give a recommended dose. Well, I went to the package insert, and if you give 13.5 mg per kg to an animal, you'll get 6 micrograms per mil in the bloodstream. Okay, so now I have at least how much I'm going to get. The next piece of information I need is the half-life. How long does it take for the drug to be eliminated? Well, bad news for you. The half-life of this drug is about 1.5 hours, and that's actually quite liberal. The half-life is actually closer to an hour. So what's that mean? Well, if I start out at 6, in one half-life, I'm down to 3. That's 1.5 hours. In two half-lives, or 3 hours, I'm now below my target. I'm now down to 1.5. What this should tell you is if you are using amoxicillin clavulinic acid at 13.5 mg per kg, you're only getting 6 micrograms per mil in the bloodstream, and chances are you shouldn't be using this drug less frequently than every 6 hours. If I've got 3 hours before I drop below the MIC, and that's 50% of the dosing interval, then that's 6 hours. And this is real. This is real. And that's for an isolate whose MIC is very low. So what can I do about it? Well, can you double the dose? Sure. If you double the dose, what you will do is you will add a half-life to the dosing interval. So you will add 1.5 hours because of the half-life, and since it's a 50%, then that would allow you to add another hour and a half. So that would be 9-hour dosing interval. If we added 2 more half-lives, then we finally will make it to our 12-hour dosing interval. To do that, then what you'll have to do is double the dose once, then double it again. So you would end up having to give 54 mg per kg to this animal to achieve an MIC, a plasma drug concentration above the MIC for a 12-hour dosing interval with a very susceptible isolate. Okay. So all I did here is I went to the literature. I said, what's my maximum drug concentration? And then I looked at the half-life, and I recognized every half-life the drug concentration would drop by 50%. And I waited to see how long it would take before I would reach my MIC. And that was my 50% point. I doubled that, and that's where I came up with my dosing interval. And unfortunately, it was only about 6 hours. If you want to add a half-life to your dosing interval, you have to double the dose. And every time you want to add another half-life, you have to double that dose. It's logarithmic. So the first time it's a doubling, the second time it's 4 times, the third time it's 8 times. So by the time everything is said and done, you're spending a lot of money, and the simpler thing would be to use a shorter dosing interval for time-dependent drugs. We should not be using amoxicillin twice a day. We should not be using it probably 3 times a day for most patients. All right, now, that also assumes that all of this drug that's in the plasma reaches the target, and that's not true. For simple and complicated infections, whatever makes it into the plasma makes it into the tissue, but for complicated infections, and the example is bronchial secretions, only 30% of amoxicillin that makes it into the plasma makes it into bronchial secretions. So that makes this even worse. And then finally, that also assumes that you have minimal inflammatory debris. Inflammatory debris is a major barrier to drug movement, and that will further preclude the ability of amoxicillin to make its way to where you want it to go. So bottom line, you probably need to be doubling the dose and giving amoxicillin 3 times a day in those at-risk patients. If you don't do it, then we'll probably just see more of the resistance that we're seeing towards, for example, E. coli towards these drugs. The best thing you can do for a critical care patient that is receiving a beta-lactam is give it as a constant rate infusion. And that's what they do in human medicine. They will set up a CRI for ampicillin or amoxicillin or imipenem, any beta-lactam, to make sure that you will have drug concentrations above the MIC throughout the dosing interval. One of the nice things, there aren't too many nice things about these slow-release penicillins, the benzathine penicillins, the procaine penicillins, remember they were designed for constant input. And they didn't know it at the time, but that probably is ingenious for a beta-lactam because that assures that your drug concentrations will stick around for the majority of the dosing interval as long as you give it frequently enough. And that's fine as long as you recognize two things. First of all, this is a lousy spectrum. Penicillin now only gets about anaerobes and maybe pastorella. Doesn't get much else. So it's not going to give you a lot of leeway without some clavulinic acid there. The other thing is these doses are ancient. They were designed for pastorella MICs that are probably half of what they are now. We need to be using these drugs at much higher doses, probably twice what we've been using them in the past. So as long as you do that, as long as you give a high enough dose to make sure you get above the MIC, then this is a good idea. The other thing that you can try and use is a drug that has a long half-life. This is Zithromax. It has sticks around for 7 days in cats. It has something like a 45-hour half-life, phenomenally long. We give it every other day. The nice thing about this drug is, yes, it's time-dependent, but because it has such a long half-life, then that makes sure drug concentrations stay above the MIC, assuming you give a high enough dose throughout the dosing interval. So that's a good thing. What about cefpodoxime? And this is how you can use package insert material to decide whether or not the way that you're going to use this drug is rational. Cefpodoxime is a third-generation cephalosporin. Now, in the earlier sessions, I warned you about extended-spectrum beta-lactamases. Cefpodoxime is susceptible to those. Culture and susceptibility testing does not detect those ESBLs. You have to have special testing procedures to detect them. So that's kind of a tangent. Just be careful with cefpodoxime. Great drug, but resistance is increasing even as we speak. The claim to fame for this third-generation cephalosporin is that you can give it once a day. So give it in lieu of cephalexin to treat pyoderma. Can you do that? Well, let's look at the package insert data. What we have down here are the MIC90s for organisms that you might target with this drug. MIC90 for Pastorella is 0.25. MIC90 for Staph intermedius and E. coli, the labeled organisms, is 0.5. MIC90 for Staph aureus is much higher at 2 micrograms per mil. Can I use this at a 24-hour dosing interval? Well, I'm going to be more conservative now, and I'm going to say I will do that as long as I have my plasma drug concentrations above the MIC for 75% of the dosing interval. I'm going to use population data here for this example. You could use the MIC for your patient and do the same sort of thing, or we can look at the population data. So if MIC 90 of 0.5 micrograms per mil is what I need, and this is what I'm going to target for 24 hours, then that means I want these plasma drug concentrations to be well above 0.5 at 18 hours, which is 75% of a 24-hour dosing interval. And you can see from this diagram you do it just fine. These are plasma drug concentrations across time following a single dose of 10 mg per kg. At the 18-hour point, my plasma drug concentrations are up there at about 3 or 4 micrograms per mil, which is well above 0.5. So no problems there. I'd be willing to use it once a day. On the other hand, if this is a Staph aureus or an organism that has a higher MIC, now I'm getting a little bit nervous because at this 18-hour point, I'm almost at plasma drug concentrations. And so if I were trying to prevent resistance and be real effective with this therapy, I might think about giving this drug twice a day to that particular patient rather than once a day. So use your package insert information, looking at how much you need and comparing it to how much you're going to get for a time-dependent drug, making sure that plasma drug concentrations are above the MIC for the majority of the dosing interval. The other group of drugs were the concentration-dependent drugs. They are exemplified by this plot right here, and in this scenario, it doesn't matter how long plasma drug concentrations are above the MIC. What's critical is that they are high enough above the MIC as we start out. And the best example, oops, sorry, went the wrong way. The best example are the fluorinated quinolones and the aminoglycosides. If you think about their mechanism of action, it makes sense. The aminoglycosides bind ribosomes. The fluorinated quinolones bind DNA gyrase. They do it irreversibly. Once it's bound, that's it for that particular ribosome or molecule. So what's critical is that we get enough in there all at once to shut things down completely. And then once they're shut down, we don't have to worry about that particular colony forming unit again. All right, so for these guys, we've got to have drug concentrations above the MIC. How high? 10 times the MIC. The recommendation now is 10 times the MIC. Plasma drug concentrations at least 10 times above the MIC. So, some examples here. This is a Pseudomonas aeruginosa causing infection in the ear of a dog. You can see that we've got susceptibility here for amikacin, and we've got susceptibility, we don't have susceptibility for Enrel, we've got intermediate. So we've got this nice pretty S, can we use amikacin to get this bug? Well, if you give amikacin at the high end of the currently labeled dose of 22 mg per kg, you will get 64 micrograms per mil, 65 micrograms per mil. How do I know that? Well, I've got a table that I showed you earlier that actually tells you that. In my textbook, I've gone through and I've gathered all the literature and I've said, okay, if you give this dose to this patient, if you give this dose to dogs or cats, you'll get this concentration in the bloodstream. So it's out there in the literature. I've had to pull this from the literature. So the literature or my table tells me that I'll get 65 micrograms per mil. Is that good enough? No, because 65 divided by 16 is 4. If you were to use amikacin in this patient with Pseudomonas, chances are, if there were any problems in this patient, you would generate a resistant bug. Now, if you're lucky, this patient responds to infection, goes away, and it doesn't come back. But if this is a problematic case, chances are the next time around this Pseudomonas would be resistant. Emrifloxacin, we have an intermediate down here. Well, that's a red flag to you. You need to be extremely careful with anything that has an intermediate because this guy has gone at least one step mutation, maybe even another. If you give 20 mg per kg of Enro, you will get 4 micrograms per mil of Enro in the bloodstream plus 2 micrograms per mil of Cipro. So you'll have 6 micrograms per mil of bioactivity. Our ratio is 6 to 1 or 6. That's not sufficient. If you treat this patient, you are probably going to have a resistant bug next time around when you reculture. Again, this is assuming that the patient is not able to get rid of the infection by itself. Now, what can you do? Well, you can use a higher dose for amikacin. You probably could get away with that, but the reality is you'd have to double to triple your dose for amikacin, and that's a little bit scary. Some patients might be able to tolerate it as long as you do it once a day or every other day, but still a little bit scary. So the other thing that you could do is combination therapy. I mean, you could add Enro and amikacin together to try and get the Pseudomonas, or you could add amikacin with a beta-lactam. If this were Enro, you could dose it twice a day, and that would help you get this bug. So the bottom line is when you see these kind of numbers, when you see these MICs that are approaching your breakpoint, it's time to be careful with your dosing regimens. This is another one. This is E. coli in the urinary tract, and you can see we've got the lowest susceptibility indicator you can get on commercial laboratory results, 0.25 micrograms per mil. Is that good enough? Well, if you use the drug at 5 mg per kg, you're going to get 1.2 micrograms per mil in the bloodstream. How do I know that? I picked up the package insert, and I looked at the package insert, and I did a little bit of extrapolating. Actually, I know it because we actually studied it. So you'll get about 1.2 micrograms per mil. What's your ratio? It's going to be greater than 5, but how much greater than 5, we don't know. So in this scenario, I think that you're getting yourself in trouble. I would much rather you use 10 mg per kg, which would get this greater than possibly 10, and maybe if this is a very problematic patient, I'd go ahead and I treat with 20 mg per kg. I wouldn't shy on my dose because I was worried about cost if this is a patient where I was really concerned about the advent of resistance. This is now I'm going to show you how you can do this with your package insert as well. This is Marbifloxacin package insert, and in this scenario, we're using as an indicator of what we need population statistics. Again, this is the MIC90 for E. coli and the MIC90 for Proteus. Our goal is to get 10 times that MIC if we are going to buy into the inhibitory quotient, if we're going to buy into this being a concentration-dependent drug. All right, well, will I do it when I give 5 mg per kg? Well, again, going to the package insert, when I give 5 mg per kg, I'm going to get 2.0 micrograms per mil of marbifloxacin in the bloodstream. What are my inhibitory quotients? Well, my Cmax over MIC is going to be 25 for E. coli. It's going to be 12 for Proteus. I could get away with, theoretically, the lower dose if I'm treating E. coli or Proteus for marbifloxacin. On the other hand, if I'm dealing with Pseudomonas, the MIC is higher. I'm going to use the 1 microgram per mil. I don't have an MIC 90 because they didn't have enough isolates here to report that out. So I'll use 1 microgram per mil. If I use the low dose, my Cmax over MIC is only 2. That's not good enough. So I'm going to think about using the higher dose. My Cmax is 4.2. 4.2 over 1 gives me a ratio of 4. That's still not good enough. What do? I use the drug twice a day. Or I use combination therapy. I add something else to my therapy. Okay, so on the other hand, if we do this for difloxacin, you can see that if we look at the ratios 0.11 compared to Cmax of, in this case, 2.3, that's for E. coli. For Proteus, 1.83 to 2.3. If we calculate our inhibitory quotients, it's great for E. coli, greater than 20, but it's terrible for Proteus. This is not a drug that you'd want to use for Proteus. What do we do for cats? I'm telling you to increase your dose. Well, the problem is they develop retinal degeneration. So one of the things I'm going to suggest that you do is use the drug that's least likely to going to cause retinal degeneration, counsel your client, and use a higher dose. This is the dose that was given. This is the number of cats that developed retinal degeneration in response to that. And you can see that marbofloxacin at 27 mg per kg or at 55 mg per kg did not cause retinal lesions in cats. And so in my mind, marbofloxacin would be the drug of choice to use in cats, and I would consider giving it at a higher dose or at least twice a day. Generic ciprofloxacin, be careful with this drug. Why? Because look at the bioavailability of this drug. In dogs, it's 40%. In cats, it's 0 to 20%. You cannot use this drug in cats. In dogs, you need to be very careful. If you're trying to get an equivalent amount of Enro, be aware of this. Every time you give Enro, you're getting Cipro. This is an animal that received 10 mg, a set of animals that received 10 mg per kg of Enro. And you can see the enrofloxacin concentrations, but the blue is the ciprofloxacin that these animals made as well. So if you add the two together, this is how much bioactivity you're going to get with Enro every time you give 10 mg per kg of Enro. If you give 10 mg per kg of Cipro, this is how much bioactivity you're going to get. So the bottom line is if you're going to use Cipro, generic Cipro, then you should increase the dose twofold for gram-negative organisms and probably 2 to 3-fold for gram-positive organisms. Transdermal gels. The nice thing about using emrofloxacin as a transdermal gel is you are not going to see resistance. And that's because you're not getting any drug in the animal. For Augmentin, there is now a generic Augmentin out there. Can you use it, since we're in the generic mode, can you use the generic Augmentin? Well, you probably can, but recognize that the ratio is markedly different in the Augmentin versus the Clavamox. And it varies. As the size of the capsule goes up, the amount of amoxicillin compared to clavulanic acid goes up as well. In other words, the amount of clavulanic acid goes down. Why? Because of side effects. The more clavulanic acid in there, the more GI upset you're going to see. And so recognize that the ratio is as high as 2 to 1 in the smaller capsules, but it's the same in the 500 milligram capsules. It's also only 2 to 1 in the liquid, whereas in all the canine preparations, feline preparations, it's 4 to 1. So you can try using it. I don't think you'll see a loss in efficacy, but you might see increased side effects. And the other one, since I'm on generics, is if you are using metronidazole benzoate and having it compounded, that's great. Cats will tolerate it much better. Just recognize that the benzoate takes up more room than does hydrochloride. And so if on a gram per gram basis, you have less metronidazole with the metronidazole benzoate compared to the hydrochloride. So you need to increase your dose by 1.6 milligrams, or by a factor of 1.6. So if you were going to give 10 milligrams per kilogram of metronidazole hydrochloride, you should be given 16 milligrams per kilogram of metronidazole benzoate. Okay, I'm going to run out of time, but I'm just going to say a couple of things about infection in the tissue. Remember that most infections are in the extracellular tissue, and most drugs will get into extracellular tissue just fine. But if you have those problematic tissues, such as the brain or the eye, or if you have marked inflammatory debris, it becomes critical to start using drugs that are lipid-soluble. And so I'm just going to remind you that the water-soluble drugs are the easiest thing to remember. They're the beta-lactams and the aminoglycosides. And every time you reach for those drugs, you need to be aware that they will not distribute to tissues nearly as well as will the lipid-soluble drugs. ideally, if you've got a complicated infection, I would much rather you reach for a lipid-soluble drug, because most of the drug that makes it into the plasma will make it to the site of infection. Whereas on this side of the schema, only about 30 to 50% of the drug that makes it into the plasma makes it into a complicated tissue. The example in the urinary tract, we use drugs that are excreted in the urine all the time because we think we're going to get much higher concentrations, and you will in the urine, but if your infection is in the kidney or the prostate, you will not get those high concentrations. And so you can't rely on those high concentrations in the urine. So again, go to a lipid-soluble drug if you're dealing with an infection in the kidney or the prostate. On the other hand, the brain is terrible to get blood drugs into. Part of the problem is it has a P-glycoprotein pump that kicks any drug that makes it in right back out. In human medicine, they will increase the dose of drugs tenfold or more so that they can make sure they get enough drug in the brain. Topical antimicrobial therapy, go for it if you can. You can get 300-fold higher drug topically than you can in the plasma. And in that scenario, culture susceptibility testing may not really be that helpful. However, if you're dealing with an ear that looks like this, you're probably going to be using the drug systemically as well, and I would use the same drug if I could topically and systemically to make sure that I get a combined effect. It's not that critical, but that's probably the way that I would do it if I could. Two other points. There are going to be microbial factors at the site, and one of the biggest challenges you're going to have is glycocalyx, and I don't want you to forget about this, so I'm going to take the time to talk about it a little bit. The calcium granules that are typical of nocardia, the glycocalyx that covers the teeth in gingival disease, even cats with chronic sinusitis. As soon as an organism adheres to the surface, it's going to start secreting a material that kind of attracts other microbes until there is this very sophisticated population of microbes. And it's kind of like a little condominium. You'll have one group on the first floor, another group on the top floor, and this guy acts as a sentinel to warn this guy down here. These guys down here secrete things to protect these guys. It's a mess. It is a mess out there. And if you don't get rid of that glycocalyx, say you have foreign bodies because you've repaired a fracture or you have this kind of stuff in the sinuses, you're not going to be able to penetrate that with your microbes. And these microbes have a very sophisticated pattern of resistance. So be aware that you need to remove that glycocalyx before you try and treat. If you have a urinary catheter in the animal, recognize that the glycocalyx there will protect the organisms in that urinary catheter, and what's causing infection in the bladder may not be the same thing that's in the urinary catheter either. So if you do have a urinary catheter in there, you don't want to pull that out and use that as your indicator of the organisms growing in your patient. The last point that I want to make is if you have marked inflammatory debris, that is a major barrier to penetration. And one of the things that you can do, if possible, is try and select a drug that accumulates in white blood cells. And the examples I'm going to show you here are all of the macrolides represented by azithromycin here, clindamycin, and all the fluorinated quinolones. If this is plasma drug concentrations, well, this is the concentration in the white blood cell. And what will happen is that white blood cell will take that drug to the site of infection, release it at the site of infection, and you'll get much higher concentrations simply because the white blood cells took it there. So if you have marked inflammatory debris, try real hard to have at least one of the drugs on board be one that accumulates the drug in white blood cells. All right, and I think these are just reasons to my point of this session is be prepared to increase the dose, especially as the MICs of your isolates are approaching the break point, or if you have an eye, or if you have a tough-to-penetrate tissue, which includes a tissue that's marked by inflammatory debris or things like glycocalyx. On the other hand, you'll shorten the interval if you're using a time-dependent drug. And when we look at duration, the last point that I'm going to make is if you believe that dead bugs don't mutate, the best thing that you can do is take that 4 to 6 weeks of therapy that you're used to giving or that 7 to 10 days of therapy that you're used to giving and cramming it into 2 to 3 days. And I'm not brave enough to tell you to do that yet, but that's where we're going in human medicine. We're taking that long spread out therapy of 7 to 10 days and we're given higher doses and shorter intervals so that we kill those bugs so that we don't have the risk of resistance. And that is where I need to end, and I'll be happy to try and answer any questions that you might have. Yes, ma'am.
What do you do about the GI side effects at the higher doses?
The GI side effects at the higher doses, and I don't have an answer. Once again, am I identifying problems? The idea of the appeal of probiotics might be one thing to do. One of the things would be giving shorter doses, you know, smaller doses at more frequent intervals. There is a new product out that is being touted, and I forget the name of it, Gastrocom, that potentially might help soothe the gastrointestinal tract. I need to see data that shows that it doesn't impair drug absorption, but if it doesn't impair drug absorption, that might be something to do as well. Good question. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Can you
compensate for the time-sensitive antibiotics by using combination antimicrobial therapy? And the answer is yes. I just want us to be a little bit careful because you still might run the risk of generating resistance more rapidly, but I think that's a much better approach. If a client, for example, just can't give it three times yet, then yeah, add another antibiotic on, maybe a fluorinated quinolone or something that you can give once a day at a longer dosing interval to try and minimize the advent of resistance. Other questions? Yes, sir.
The NIC breakpoint, they don't IDEX doesn't include that now.
No, neither IDEX nor ANTEC include the MIC breakpoint on their reports. And the reason that they don't is because the automated systems that they use don't do that. And I am working on them to do that. To me, it makes perfect sense that veterinarians should see these numbers. Otherwise, how does that number help you? I mean, it just boggles my mind that they give you the MIC, but they don't give you the threshold to compare that to. So, but they do tell me, both of them tell me, that those numbers are on their website. And it should be in your notes. I think I gave you that table in your notes. Okay, then email me and I'll give it to you if you want. But you should be able to get it from IDEX of all the drugs that CLASI has come up with guidelines for, and those are the only ones that will be tested because they won't test for anything that doesn't have a breakpoint MIC. Okay. Other questions, comments? Thank you so. I'll stay up here. Thank you so very much.